Hello and welcome to the Old Time Radio Hour. I'm your host, Justine Ward, and each week we bring you a classic show from radio's golden age. This week we have two more episodes of Columbia Workshop from the amazing imagination of Norman Corwin, who was known as the Poet Laureate of radio. During 1941, Corwin took on an incredible challenge, creating 26 weekly shows that take the audience anywhere the human imagination can go. First, we have an imaginative show with Venus, the Roman goddess of love, visiting Boston, Massachusetts. Venus and the gods try to make sense out of 1940s America. It's wonderfully clever and so entertaining. The Columbia Workshop, Descent of the Gods, first broadcast August 3rd, 1941 on CBS.
Pardon me, will you, while I tune my dulcimer? I like to accompany my own narration.
The Columbia Workshop presents number 13 of 26 by Corwin.
You know, unless you've ever been a god yourself, you have no way of knowing how dull immortality can get to be sometimes. Take my word for it, friends. I'm a god of long standing. How'd you like a little shot of a minuet?
Descent of the Gods, a speculative fantasy by Norman Corwin, having to do with some familiar gods in unfamiliar circumstances.
I'm a little-known Greek god named Nick. Little-known because I happen to be the god of trivia, which is about as exciting as being a 16th vice president in a gimlet factory. Very boring work. In fact, it's under the heading of trivia that this chronicle comes. You know, all history's trivial to a god, since it's always repeating itself like gossip. I'm only taking the time to tell the story about the visits of Venus, Mars, and Apollo because I think you ought to hear a running account, not merely the fragmentary accounts that appeared in your press and radio from time to time. Anyway, it was in the fall of 1942 that Venus got it into her head to visit the New World. Now, first let me clear up which Venus I'm referring to. There are all kinds of Venuses. I don't mean any of the imitation Venuses, like the Venus Genetrix or the Venus of Milo, Venus of the Steel Pier, Atlantic City, Verticordia, Medicean, Capitoline Venus. I mean Venus, the original goddess of love and beauty herself, and not just a reasonable facsimile or plaster cast of same. As I say, it was in 42 that Venus, having read of the United States in a book called Bullfinch's Earth, decided to visit the place. How she got there is none of your business. As a matter of fact, I'm prohibited from telling you any of the details of life among the gods due to a ruling of Deletius, the god of censorship. Suffice it to say, her descent was full of a good deal of razzle-dazzle and fireworks and Roman candles, and the Roman gods make a big production out of those things. We Greek gods take it a lot easier. But the first thing most of you knew about it was when a network radio program was interrupted to bring you the news.
We interrupt the program of the Four Horsemen to bring you the following bulletin.
Boston, Mass. Police and civic authorities are puzzled over the appearance early tonight of a beautiful woman who claimed she is the goddess Venus. Bewildered spectators reported that she descended on a brilliant shaft of light on Boylston Street in the heart of the city shortly after 8. At first, she was mistaken for some movie exploitation in connection with the opening of a new picture. Asked what she was doing in Boston, she said she had read a reference to that city as the hub of the universe and wanted to see what a hub of the universe looked like. An investigating committee of legal experts and police have referred the case to immigration authorities. A public hearing will be held tomorrow. For further details, read your paper.
We now return you to the program of the Four Horsemen.
Well, the dispatch was right. Venus was quizzed by a court of experts. And if you can think of anything more undignified for a goddess than to be quizzed by a court of experts, just mail the suggestion to me in care of trivia. The story was, of course, treated by the press and radio with a proper degree of sensationalism. Why, in some quarters, the visit was looked upon as the most terrific thing to happen since the release of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, which, you may remember, had been previously hailed by one of your columnists, a certain Westbrook Pegler, as the greatest thing to hit the earth since the armistice. However, it was the hearing before the special committee at Boston that first brought Venus into sharp encounter with some of your finest minds.
All right, that will be enough picture-taking for the present. Will the press photographers kindly clear out? Clear the court, please. We will now proceed with the inquiry. Gentlemen of the board, will you begin your questioning?
No, Miss Venus. Unaccustomed as we are to public appearances of deities, we feel that we cannot simply accept your word of godship, but we must ask for credentials. Have you any?
Dei homines melius tractant, quam homines deos. Numquam rogavimus, ut aliqui ex illustribus patribus vestret, aut signo, aut documento mortalitatem probaverint.
You get what she means, Saltonstall?
No, but I think she's talking French as far as I can.
We'd better get Professor Huntington to translate it. Professor Huntington, would you kindly translate the testimony of the witness for the benefit of those in the committee who have gotten a little rusty in their knowledge of French?
The witness said in Latin, quote, "The gods are more hospitable to mortals than mortals to the gods. Never have we asked any of your illustrious ancestors to prove by signs or symbols their mortality," unquote.
Yes. Now, madam, you have been heard to speak English prior to this investigation. Why did you choose to reply to my colleague, Mr. O'Shaughnessy, in Latin?
Because Latin is one of my credentials.
I see. Have you any others?
Apparently by credentials, you mean something of sufficient supernatural force to convince you I am other than a human being. In an earlier day, such impudence was answered by the visitation of catastrophe. Floods and holocausts and famine were hurled upon the heads of mortals in exaction of due expiation.
Will you answer Mr. Saltonstall's question, please?
Answer yes or no.
If you keep insisting on it, I'll give you credentials of the most convincing sort. One appeal to Jupiter Fulgur, and you'll be struck right in the middle of the committee by a bolt of lightning.
Miss Venus, this hearing will simply not tolerate any attempted intimidation. Moreover, another remark of this sort, and we will be obliged to cite you for contempt of the committee.
What about contempt of the gods?
Now, just a moment, madam. We are merely trying to establish whether, in what even you will admit is a strange situation, we are being hoaxed. If you are indeed a Roman goddess, we have certain restrictions regarding immigration which must be complied with.
Yes. And if you cannot prove to our satisfaction that you are what you have claimed to be, then we must recommend arraignment on a number of charges, such as flying without a license in violation of federal aeronautical regulations.
Exactly.
Flying low over a thickly populated area in violation of municipal ordinances, attempting to deceive officers of the law, perjury, contempt of court.
Then I suppose I must convince you. Since it would no doubt constitute contempt of the committee to strike dead any of its honorable members, I will call upon my worthy cousin, Jupiter Fulgur, to destroy by lightning the chandelier directly over the center of the courtroom as a token credential.
Well, we might as well be practical about this. Will the spectators sitting in the center of the courtroom please clear the area directly under the chandelier? That's it. Now then, please proceed, Miss Venus.
Jupiter Fulgur, Jupiter Fulminator, I, Venus, call upon thee to ascend from the altar of Campus Martius and to strike with your ready wrath the main lighting fixture of courtroom 12A, Suffolk County Courthouse, Boston, Massachusetts. It takes a little time to warm up. But it'll be along any minute.
Order in the court! Order in the court! The cameraman will please not take any pictures until recess is called.
Clerk.
Yes, Your Honor.
Will you please enter the fallen chandelier as Exhibit A?
Yes, sir.
And then call an electrician to repair the lighting system. It seems Jupiter Fulgur blew out all the fuses.
Yes, sir.
The hearing will now continue. Miss Venus, I think we are satisfied with your credentials. Yes,
but, Mr. Chairman, since she's a foreign goddess, what assurance have we that she's not a fifth columnist or an agent of foreign propaganda?
No, Fitzpatrick. I think that question is improper in view of existing evidence.
Still, there would be no harm in having Venus register with the State Department.
That is entirely a matter for the jurisdiction of the federal government and nothing for us to decide in this hearing.
Yes, that's
Now, unless there is dissenting opinion from the committee, I will declare the witness to be an accredited deity of sound mind and with the recommendation that the usual formalities of registration be waived and that the hospitality of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts and of its sister states be extended to her as long as she remains on these shores.
Well, that took care of Venus's reception. Of course, there was some talk about having her investigated by the Dyes Committee. A number of pressure groups wanted to have her deported immediately on the grounds that she might be a potential danger to the youth of the country. But nothing came of this, and in the meantime, she was offered all kinds of new propositions every day.
Miss Venus, would you be available on the coast on the 28th to judge a beauty contest at Venice, California? We're selecting the most beautiful hat check girl in the United States, west of Denver, and we were wondering
if you... the Federated Women's Clubs of North and South Carolina, we extend you a cordial invitation to speak at the annual convention of the FWC.
I'm telling you, darling, we put an orchestra behind you and get a good MC who can sing like Donna Meachie, see? And get Lynn Murray's chorus to give it class and a good comedy team, and I'll guarantee you the biggest hopper's rating on the air. Now, we can call it the Venus Varieties, or Venus Presents, or 26 by Venus, or something like that, and get a soap of perfume.
I'd like to see any other studio beat our terms. Now, look, one picture a year for $100,000. What? Garbo don't get that much, and she's had more experience in pictures than you. Now you'll have your own choice of material, director, cameraman, and supporting cast.
We'd like to make you an offer to endorse our new screen line of Vanity Girl.
Which I am 41 years old and a bachelor, very well off, and been looking for a wife.
Would you be interested in doing a 10-minute guest spot on We the People?
Would you sign your autograph on the back of this menu and write something under it for my nephew? His name is Oliver W.
We would appreciate the use of your name as one of the patrons of the Committee on the Conservation of Everything by the Use of Nothing Society's annual dinner and entertainment.
Magazines, soaps, dishes. Movie actors, animals, and gods. I'm writing an article for
the young girl of 28, and I've been going out with two men off and on for 6 years, and one of them has pimples, and the other tells me he's afraid to get married.
In downtown Los Angeles, and we were wondering if it would be possible.
But Venus accepted none of these propositions. She said she was a goddess and not a celebrity. She traveled incognito and alone. She went into high places and humble places, and she looked and she saw. And when she'd seen what she wanted to see, she came back to the East and she announced she was going to return to the home of the gods. Well, there were so many requests for interviews before she left, she granted a press conference and the reporters kept her busy answering questions.
What would you say were the outstanding observations you made during your stay, Venus?
Well, you appreciate that I must, of course, confine my comments to matters affecting love and beauty. Those are the matters over which I have suzerainty, so to speak.
Why are you confined to that subject only?
Jove only knows.
Well, what do you have to report about American love and beauty?
Only wholesome things. Here in the new world as in the old, you mortals love beauty, and you love love. By chance, Felicity, a few enjoy the symmetry and charm of an endowed and innate beauty. Still another few possess the means of such felicity, affording as they do the ointments and the jeweled waters. But these are few and rare. The millions of you, yes, the multi-millions of you, each wants to look beautiful and well to others and yourself. The girl at the machine, the elevator boy, the weary typist and the shipping clerk, the busy housewife straightening out the house before she goes to town to meet her husband, the schoolgirl primping in the corridor. They all want beauty and good looks. Each last one likes the smell of new, clean things to wear. Some of them cannot afford to buy a hairdo or to straighten out their teeth. Others wear their glad rags only once a week. Some never, having only sad rags. But always they are hoping things will be better, hoping they will be better. Always they'd like to earn a little more, to stay ahead, to put a little by. And as for love, who would not be a part of that? How low must one be before he cannot dream of loving and of being loved? No, my domain will never shrink. On yours still, I will be goddess of the great...
That's me, Nick. I can handle a harp as good as a dulcimer. Nothing to it. Well, Venus talked to them for 20 minutes without stopping, and then she disappeared in a cloud of fine Roman incense. Before she left, she said she'd recommend the country to a couple of other gods, Mars and Apollo, whom she thought might be interested. And they were, apparently. Why, Mars got so hepped up over Venus's account on the 1st of March, the month named after him. He's quite an exhibitionist, you know. He arrived on the roof of the War Department at Washington by special arrangement. You Americans by that time were getting accustomed to welcoming ancient gods, and there was a 21-gun salute, fine speech by the Secretary of War, and so forth. And Mars, who's never been what you'd call exactly glib, rather bungled it a little. Obviously, he'd been boning up for his visit on an old edition of Bullfinch's Earth, because after the Army and Navy chiefs had welcomed him, he pulled a boner.
Thank you. Thank you. It is an honor and a privilege to be received in this cordial manner. And I am looking forward eagerly to meeting your splendid General George Washington, whose exploits I have been studying with great interest. I would also like to extend my felicitations to your naval hero, Admiral John Paul Jones, whose victory over the French and Indians in the great Battle of Bull Run was remarkable in the
lucky,
annals of military
lucky for
and
Mars,
naval conquest.
Everybody
and more
took
than
it
that,
as a big
the
joke,
of
see? They thought that was just his prankish way of giving the military bigwigs a hot foot. There was a great deal of parading, receptions at various embassies, and he was engaged to write a military column in PM as the guest of the general. He was interviewed by Major George Fielding Elliott over CBS. There was an article by General Hugh Johnson attacking him for something he said. And he was signed up as a technical advisor on a new war film. But he left two fiascos in his wake before he finally went home. The first one was in connection with information, please, on which he was invited to be one of the four experts, along with John Kieran, FTA, and Deems Taylor. It seems that Fadiman had some special questions pertaining to war, but Mars didn't know any of the answers.
Wait a minute now. I don't know.
But Kieran knew. Next thing that happened, he was invited to attend some army maneuvers, and he went along in a staff car with two majors and a colonel. And the only trouble was that Mars had never seen a machine gun before, to say nothing of tanks and planes and flamethrowers. And when the heavy maneuvers started... Why,
what are those fearful instruments, Colonel?
Those are some of our new 20-ton tanks.
Dear, dear, very frightening. And what are those?
Why, our new six-motored flying fortresses, the OV-203s. Above them is a squadron of our improved dive bombers, the X-122.
Colonel, I'm afraid I don't feel very well.
Now, there are some of our new 30-mile guns operating from railroad emplacement.
I think perhaps I'd better...
Why, Major, our guest is getting very pale.
What?
Oh, I say, aren't you feeling well, Mars?
Oh.
Good heavens. Mars has fainted. Get some water, quickly.
Stop the maneuvers! Stop the maneuvers! Stop the maneuvers!
Yeah. Mars toppled right over in a dead faint when the artillery opened up. Took a hose of cold water to revive him. And when he recovered from the shock, he decided to go back home and sit in a nice, quiet pantheon until his nerves settled down. However, he managed to hold a press conference before he left.
I must admit, man's progress in arms has been astounding. In ancient times, a man's strength, skill, and valor had something to do with his fighting. But today, I observe that detonating power of various nitrogen compounds, the trajectory of a shell, the thickness of steel plating, and the revolutions per minute of a gasoline engine are of greater importance. You make thicker armor to stop bigger shells, and then you have to make bigger shells to pierce the thicker armor. Truly amazing. Now, I am going to make a confession, gentlemen. The real reason for my collapse during the recent army maneuvers was not, as you so charitably reported, due to something I ate, but was the result of complete shock and panic. Yes, you may well be surprised, but your surprise is hardly comparable to the sensation which I experienced when I fully realized that the godship of war has, in effect, passed from my hands to that of mankind. In fact, I am seriously contemplating the possibility of resigning as god of war.
That's Mars for you. Grandstand play every time. Didn't mean a word of it. Just a gag. He knew he'd done nothing very remarkable during his visit, so he had to make a great splash on the way out. Succeeded, all right, because for a whole month after that, Walter Lippmann and Dorothy Thompson were writing opinions on the subject. And just as the excitement over Mars began to subside, Apollo came down for a visit. No flashbulbs or fanfare about his descent. He just showed up one afternoon at the Greek embassy in Washington, and he went soberly about the business of registering the civilized way.
I should like to register through the proper channels.
Sure, I got a channel right here. What is your name, sport?
I am Apollo, better known to the ancestors of your great country as the god of music and culture.
Well, of course, soon as the story got out, he was swamped with telegrams and cablegrams and radiograms and offers and propositions.
And we would be deeply honored to have you join a symposium on the subject of present-day tendencies in the music and education.
The Museum of Modern Art cordially invites you to dedicate an all-Apollo exhibition at 4
Would you consent to toss out the second ball in the World Series?
Dear Apollo, my little boy is studying music, and I have great difficulty in making him practice.
Therefore, we thought it might make a striking program if you were to be one of the four guests on People's Platform this week. The subject is Western Culture, Is It Worth Preserving? Other participants will be a taxi driver, the editor of Western Culture magazine, and a soda jerker from a chain.
Dear Apollo, I've seen your pictures in the paper, and I think you are the most handsome man I've ever seen. I would trade you for Clark Gable or Tyrone Power any day. Now, I have a little favor.
Apollo accepted some of those offers because he was interested. No stuffed shirt, he. He said he was glad to appear on the People's Platform with a soda jerk and a taxi driver because he thought little men and big men should talk things over oftener. He coined an epigram about little men, which I pasted in my scrapbook of trivia. Quote, "The little man is a bigger man than a big man whenever he gets together with more little men." End quote. Apollo stood in fine with everybody, he did. Why, around commencement time, he was given 7 degrees in 6 days.
Doctor of Law at Harvard.
Thank you.
LLM at Catawba.
Thank you very much.
PhD at South Dakota State College of Agriculture.
I'm greatly honored.
Doctor of Fine Arts at Princeton.
I'm very happy to receive this degree.
Doctor of Humanics at Oglethorpe.
A rare privilege.
Master of Music at Juilliard.
A pleasure and an honor.
D. Litt at Sweetbriar.
Thank you so much.
He covered a lot of ground, Apollo did. And his modesty and his gentle Greek bearing won him many friends. Of course, musicians and theorists were after him day in and day out because he naturally knew all there was to be known about music. Sometimes he was dragged into some pretty high-flown discussions.
But of course, Apollo, the question is this. Does a hypomixolydian tonality resemble a major key with either an excessive emphasis on the subdominant or a top-heavy and ultimately prevalent dominant?
Pardon me, but that is not the question, Harkness.
Hmm?
We must be careful not to impute relationships to keys separated from discursive modulation unless we have strong collateral evidence from the key functions of a definite musical pattern. Don't you agree, Apollo?
But the perfect example of my point is the use of the triskydica hyperhendica enea heptachord.
Gentlemen, The question seems simpler to me than that.
Yes, Apollo?
What do you consider the issue, Apollo?
Is the music any good?
Well, things went along, and Apollo got to be so popular that his admirers urged him to stick around, take out citizenship papers. Some of them even wanted him to run for office. There was a special Apollo issue of Fortune. Series of articles about him in the Saturday Evening Post. And a pulp magazine feature claiming to tell the true love story of Apollo. But none of this seemed to bother him much. One day he just up and said he was going home. Unlike Venus and Mars, he didn't hold any press conference. But he did give a radio talk just before disappearing into the night mists over Madison Avenue.
I've been asked to make a few farewell remarks concerning my impressions of the state of mortal man. They are these. Man is greater than the gods in many ways, and lower than the ant in many others. He can fly the air and swim under the sea and fling his voice around the world, turn night into day with filaments, grind lenses which draw the moon down until its mountain peaks are barely 20 miles away. Take pictures of men's insides from without. Send heat and light and horsepower across 400 miles of desert in a copper wire. Listen to the sounds of seven continents by fingering a knob. Or clock the yawning heavens with a trigger hair. And tell you 20,000 years ahead what second, of what minute, of what hour, of what day the sun will be eclipsed, and where the fleeting shadow will be seen. Man can make music that will hold a million other men transfixed, can weigh the very earth he stands on, freeze by heating, move a mountain with some sticks, press shapeless masses into solid blocks, teach fleas to dance. Yet, give this wonder man a simple problem such as how to keep from killing several million other wonder men just like himself each 20 years or so, and he is baffled and distraught. This man who understands the vast complexity of logarithms and who has a formula for harmony and chemistry, for logic and hydraulics and for stress and strain, just give this man the problem of some surplus livestock on the one hand and some hungry men who cannot buy that livestock on the other, and he'll fume and fret and make up laws and regulations, and then finally destroy the livestock and leave the hungry men still hungry. This man who knows more than the gods do of the spectrum of a star, who comprehends the structure of a leaf, splits atoms and counts molecules, traps whales and diagrams a bug's anatomy, knows not enough to grasp the simplest truths and bend them to his will. He hails the golden rule as golden, then puts it on a shelf to be forgotten, and he makes new rules of lead. But I shall not despair, for man has in him all the seeds of his own betterment, and one day they shall sprout. When that day comes, the vine shall reach to heaven and the gods climb down. Now I have finished, and I will go back to my Olympus. Goodbye, my hospitable mortals. Good fortune to your seed.
Well, so then he went home. That's all. Simple as that. Haven't been any gods to send since then, so there's no more to the story. I'll keep you posted if anything turns up. That's my job now. Nick, the Greek god of trivia. That's me. If anything you want to know that's not worth knowing, just drop a card to trivia in care of Nick. Yeah, Dulcimer's gone, gotten out of tune again. Oh, well.
The Columbia Workshop has brought you Descent of the Gods, written and directed by Norman Corwin as number 13 in the workshop cycle, 26 by Corwin. Nick, the Greek god of trivia, was played by Henry Morgan, better known to radio as Here's Morgan. Venus by Eileen Burns, Apollo by House Jameson, and Mars by Winfield Honey. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
You're listening to the Old Time Radio Hour, broadcast each week over the World Wide Web with your host, Justine Ward. Next, the genius of Norman Corwin recounts a biblical story from the Old Testament. Norman Corwin created a wonderful opera from the story of Esther. Since Purim just passed, this is the right time of year. The story of Esther and her nemesis, Haman, is called the Megillah. It's a Jewish tradition to read it all the way through. If you've ever heard the expression, the whole Megillah, that is where it comes from. This is one of three biblical stories that Corwin did in 26 by Corwin. He also used the stories of Samson and Job. Norman Corwin always includes a philosophical twist. Enjoy the Columbia Workshop 26 by Corwin, Esther, first broadcast August 17th, 1941 on CBS.
Esther, a new biblical opera by Lynn Murray and Norman Corwin, presented as number 15 in the Columbia Workshop cycle, 26 by Corwin, and featuring Martin Gable, Arnold Moore, Everett Sloan, Joan Vitez, and Winston O'Keefe.
Now it came to pass, in the days of Ahasuerus, reign from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, I do hereby proclaim this year of my reign the biggest feast ever seen in thee. For 6 months we'll make merry and let workers stay alone and sing and dance and celebrate the glory of the throne.
And there was a big feast in Shushan.
Was a big feast in Shushan, left the shank in Shushan, they chewed the rag in Shushan, they served all dishes in Shushan, they drank like fishes in Shushan, oh Shushan, Shushan, Shushan.
When the heart of the king was merry with wine, and he was in his cups and he was feeling fine, four sheets to the wind and under the weather, he called his seven chamberlains together.
Now, gentlemen, we're turned to your majesty, Queen Vashti.
Vashti's giving a party in the royal house.
For women only.
Oh, yes. Well, bring her here to me.
Yes, right away, your majesty.
Yes, right away, your majesty. Yes, right away, your majesty.
Now, Vashti, she was spirited and highly independent. Of purple-blooded Persians, a proud descendant. Her bearing, it was regal, and her attitude was bold. And when the chamberlains arrived, her compliments were cold.
What do you want?
His Imperial Majesty requests the presence of Her Imperial Majesty at the feast in the garden of the court of the palace.
Oh, does he? Tell him I'm busy with my own guests.
But, madam...
Annoy me no further. I refuse to go with you.
But, your highness...
Did you hear me?
Yes, your Imperial Majesty.
Very well. Now get out.
Memucan.
Yes, your Majesty.
You are reputed to be the sagest of the seven princes of Persia?
Yes, your majesty.
That is why I sent for you. I need your advice.
Yes, your majesty.
You are a very wise fellow, Memucan. If you can't advise me, who can? Nobody! The queen has disobeyed an imperial command. She has broken with tradition. She has gotten out of hand. So how am I to act now? What conclusions do you draw? What can we do unto the queen according to the law?
Sire, in my opinion, Vashti the queen has wronged not only the king, but also the princes and all the people in the provinces.
For this deed of the queen will be noised among the wives, and they'll despise their husbands all the rest of their lives. Likewise, will all the ladies scorn the princes of the sire. I fear the low example will arouse contempt and ire.
What to do about it?
Let a law be written by which Vashti might be smitten by the loss of her royal estate. Then choose another queen who is not so mean.
Let the fight
that Scribe, take a decree.
Yes, Your Majesty.
I, Ahasuerus, decree that Queen Vashti shall be deprived of her royal estate for just and good causes, and that every man in my kingdom shall bear rule in his own house.
And so the queen was divorced, and Ahasuerus was alone in the palace, and he was very lonely.
What matters pomp? What matters glory? What matters riches of song and story? What matters my kingdom? What matters my throne, so long as I'm alone?
Then said the king's servant that ministered unto him,
Sire, we have a suggestion.
What is it?
Let the king appoint officers in all the provinces, that they may gather together fair young maidens in the Shushan, the palace. Let the maiden which pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti.
Let it be done.
What matters pomp? What matters glory? What matters loss that are written down?
Now in Shushan there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, and he brought up Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful. So it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decree was heard, and when many maidens were gathered together unto Shushan the palace, that Esther was brought also unto the king's house. And Esther showed not her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had charged her that she should not show it. So Esther went into the royal house of Ahasuerus. What is your name?
My name is Esther.
It is a pretty name.
Thank you, Your Majesty.
And very becoming. Sit beside me, Esther. You're very beautiful. Of what family are you?
A common family. My father was Abihail.
And of what people are you?
An ancient people.
How ancient?
Ancient as Persia.
Esther, Do you think you could love the emperor of 127 provinces, king of the Persians, king of the Medes?
Yes.
But what do you know about love, little Esther? Grace and favor in his sight, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti.
But then came Haman. Haman was a wicked man, but all the servants in the king's gate bowed in reverence to Haman, for the king had promoted him above all the princes. Only Mordecai bowed not. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, he was full of wrath.
Who is that dog of a dog who will not bow down to me?
That, Your Excellency, is Mordecai, the Jew.
All others bow to me. He alone remains standing in the gate. I'll see about that. You, Mordecai, down on your knees.
Well, down, Jew. Haman has spoken.
I bow only to God.
Down, you fool!
You've had my answer.
You'll die for this cursed old man.
Why do you refuse to bow, you swine?
Speak up, Greybeard. Answer the Grand Vizier.
I will not bow down to a man on a horse. I will not bow down to a crown. I will never yield to a tyrant's force, though I burn or hang or drown. I will never worship a grand vizier, or his sons, or his nephews, or nieces. There's only one ruler whom I fear, though I be chopped in a thousand pieces. I will not kiss the earth that you have trod, though I be whipped all day for it. I will bow down only to the living God, though death be the price I pay for it.
Shall I arrest this man, Your Excellency?
No, don't contaminate yourself. I have a better plan in mind for dealing with Mordecai and his kind. Come along, Captain.
Thank you.
Bride, come here.
Yes, Your Excellency.
Set this down. To the king's lieutenants and to the governors and the rulers of every people of every province, and order as follows. To destroy, to kill, to cause to perish all Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. The day of the 12th month, and to take the spoil of them for a prey.
Very well, Your Excellency.
Inscribe this order immediately and return to me here. Thus shall I avenge the insult of Mordecai. He and his people shall perish as one.
The best way to bolster authority is to bully a small minority. I shall slay with the sword all those I hate. They'll grovel in the dirt before Haman and Bain. On the scattered and the few will my wrath be heard. Then I'll seize the crown and conquer the world. I'll begin by making a scapegoat race and broaden my scope and quicken my pace. Oh, the best way to bolster authority is to bully a small minority. I'll rule with iron every Persian and Mede. I'll make them sweat and I'll make them bleed. With gross and poisonous lies I'll feed them and hold in my grip all life and freedom. I'll begin by making a scapegoat race and kill them off without a trace. Oh, the best way to bolster authority is to fully assault my authority.
Mordecai.
Quiet. Listen.
What are you doing inside the palace? You'll be killed if you're found here.
That's why I must speak quickly. Did you get my message about Haman's decree to massacre the Jews?
What's to be done?
Esther, you must go into the king and make supplication to him in behalf of your people.
But don't you know the law? Whoever goes into the king without being called shall be put to death.
Except such to whom the king shall hold out the golden scepter.
But I've not been called to come into the king for the past 30 days.
Esther, don't think that you shall escape in the king's house any more than the rest of your people. For if you altogether hold your peace now, then deliverance shall arise from another place. But you and your father's house shall be destroyed. Who knows but what you are come to the kingdom for just such a time as this?
Very well. I will go unto the king, which is not according to law. And if I perish, I perish.
Where are the proclamations awaiting my seal?
Here, Your Majesty.
Very well. And while I seal these with the king's ring, go tell Memucan, who stands with Haman, that I would have a word with him.
Yes, sire. Your Excellency.
Yes?
His Majesty the King requests that you consult with him as soon
as... Wait a moment. I believe my eyes. Is that Queen Esther standing here in the court, though not called by the King?
Why, this is a grave transgression of the law.
Punishable by death unless the King holds forth his scepter.
Quiet, the King is these.
Queen Esther!
May it please the King!
Come. Touch the scepter which I hold forth.
My sire.
What is your request, Queen Esther?
If it please the king to grant my petition, Let the king and Haman come tomorrow to a banquet which I've prepared for them.
Is that all? Let it be done, Queen Esther, and let Haman be so advised.
Invited nobody to the banquet but myself and the king. Why, this is the greatest honor that has ever been bestowed upon any man in the kingdom. But it avails me nothing so long as I see Mordecai sitting at the king's gate. Mordecai, who will not bow down to me, though the rest of Shushan kiss the dirt under my feet. I believe I shall hang the knave. I will build a gallows today, 50 cubits high, here before my own house, so that I may see it. And tomorrow I will petition the king that Mordecai be hanged. Yes. But first to build the gallows.
On that night, the king could not sleep. And he commanded to bring the books of the records of the chronicles. And they were read before the king.
In the 8th year of the reign of Ahasuerus, 2 of the king's chamberlains sought to lay hands upon the king to murder him. But the thing was known to a man named Mordecai, who told it to the officers of the king. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out, and therefore the criminals were hanged. And on the 8th day...
Just a moment. I don't even remember this thing. What honor has been done Mordecai for making known the plot against me?
Nothing was done for him.
Nothing? Who's in the court right now?
Haman, to petition the king concerning the hanging of a citizen of Shushan.
Tell him to come in.
Yes, your majesty.
And unkindness has been done unto Mordecai. His service to the throne should have been acknowledged long before this. But for his vigilance, I might be dead.
May it please the king, the grand vizier.
Haman, a question.
Yes, your majesty.
What shall be done to a man whom the king delights to honor?
A man whom the king delights to honor? For the man whom the king delights to honor, bring the royal apparel which the king wears, and the horse which the king rides, and the crown which is set upon his head. And let one of the king's most noble princes array the man withal, and bring him on horseback through the city, and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done. The man whom the king delights to honor.
Very good, Haman. Now make haste and take the apparel and the horse as you have suggested, and do so to Mordecai, who sits at the gate. Don't overlook anything you've suggested.
Haman had to honor Mordecai according to his own device. And after that, he went to the banquet with the king and Esther the queen.
Now, what is the petition you've saved up for this banquet, Queen Esther?
If I found favor in your sight, and if I pleased the king...
Yes?
Then spare my life and spare my people's.
Spare your life, your people. What do you mean, Queen?
We are sold, I and my people.
Sold? By what enemy of the king would kill the queen? Who is he and where is he that dares presume in his heart to do so?
He is with us, and his name is Haman. He has issued a decree to massacre the Jews who are my people.
No, no, it is not
the adversary and the enemy. It is this very man.
Haman, have you perverted the command I entrusted unto you because I believed in the wisdom of your counsel?
No, your majesty. Allow me to explain.
Why do you stammer so?
The matter is not what it seems, your majesty.
I have rung for the chamberlain Harbona. We will make inquisition whether you lie against the word of the queen.
But, your majesty, if it please the king,
Harbona, apprehend this man. He has conspired to destroy the queen and her people.
I am innocent of this. Bear witness for me, chamberlain.
What do you know of this, Harbona?
I know only that the grand vizier has lately built a gallows 50 cubits high for Mordecai.
For Mordecai? Where is this gallows that will prove enough?
It stands in the house of Haman.
Is that so, Haman?
Yes, but you see, it was...
Harbona!
be written to reverse the letters devised by Haman to destroy these people.
Your Majesty!
Let it be granted that these people gather themselves together and stand for their life to destroy those who attack them on the 13th day of the 12th month. Let it be known that they should be ready on that day to avenge themselves on their enemies.
Yes, Your Majesty.
And as for Haman, take him away. Cover up his face and hang him on the gallows he prepared in his house.
No! No, Your Majesty, no! No!
And Haman stood upon the gallows.
Haman stood upon the gallows he built in his own house, wherewith to hang Mordecai.
And they hanged Haman on the gallows.
Let this be a lesson to vain men who lust for limitless power. Let this notify profane men that there comes a reckoning hour. Let this point a moral that the only truce with a traitor and tyrant is a gallows noose.
Let this be a lesson to great men who rule and command and lead. Never trust in men who hate men because of their race or creed. Let this point a moral that the only truth with a bully and a bigot is a gallows noose. Let this be a lesson to the vain men who lust for limitless power. Let this notify profane men that there comes a reckoning hour. Let this point a moral that the only truth with a traitor and a tyrant is the gallows noose. Is the
king took off his ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai. And Esther the queen enjoined her people to establish among them the month which was turned unto them from mourning into a good day, that they should make days of feasting and joy. All these acts, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia?
That was Esther, a new opera by Lynn Murray and Norman Corwin, presented as the second in the Old Testament trilogy. The role of Esther was sung by Genevieve Rowe, that of Ahasuerus by Harrison Knox, Mordecai by Eugene Lowenthal, and Haman by Kenneth Schoen. Next week at this same time, Columbia will present Charles Lawton in a literal adaptation of the Book of Job as the last of the Old Testament trilogy, for which production Dean Taylor has composed a special score, his first for radio. This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
You have been listening to the Old Time Radio Hour, broadcast each week over the World Wide Web. You can subscribe at no charge through Apple Podcasts, Podbean, or RSS. Thank you so much for listening. We hope you can join us again next week for another hour of entertainment from the golden age of radio. Until then, this is your host, Justine Ward, saying, so long for a while.